It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Identity of an Al-Shabaab gunman in Kenya massacre revealed. The son of a Kenyan government official was one of those masked Al-Shabaab gunmen who massacred 148 people at Garissa University College last week. Kenya's Interior Ministry says Abdirahim Abdullahi was among four attackers killed. The news came as Kenyans dedicated Easter Sunday services to the massacre victims. Many churches in Kenya hired armed guards to protect their Easter congregations. The country is also observing a three-day period of mourning. Pope Francis marked the Holy Day with a Roman Catholic Mass in St. Peter's Square. He prayed for an end to the persecution of Christians, referring to the students massacred at Garissa University in Kenya. In Jerusalem, thousands of Christians gathered at the site where many believe Jesus was crucified and buried. Robert Berger reports.
Thine be the glory, risen conquering Son.
Easter celebrations began in Jerusalem with a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb. Pilgrims sang hymns of the resurrection in the scenic garden, which resembles the place where Jesus was buried according to biblical accounts. Facing an empty tomb carved into a rock, they proclaimed that Jesus is risen. Robert Berger in Jerusalem's Old City.
Egyptian security forces say they have killed the leader and founder of the extremist group Ajnad Masir in a shootout at a Cairo apartment. Hamam Mohammed Atiyah was shot dead during a firefight in a residential neighborhood. The group did not comment on his death, but hours later claimed a bombing that killed a policeman. Egyptian officials say the explosion at a bridge in central Cairo killed a police officer and wounded two. This is VOA News. Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen have arrested more than 120 members of a rival Islamic Sunni party. The Houthis raided homes and offices in the capital Sana'a, rounding up members of the ISLA party, which has ties to Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. ISLA also backs the Saudi-led coalition airstrikes against the Houthis. The raids came as senior Houthi leader Saleh al-Samad said the rebels are willing to hold peace talks if the Saudis stop the bombing. A monitoring group says Islamic militants are in control of most of a large Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says fighters from the Islamic State and al-Nusra Front gained control of about 90% of the Yarmouk refugee camp. The two groups fought other rebels, including a Syrian-Palestinian militia who opposed the Syrian government. UN officials said Syrian forces were shelling the camp. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is slamming the new international framework agreement with Iran, saying it leaves what he called the preeminent terrorist state with a vast nuclear infrastructure that will ultimately give it nuclear weapons. Appearing on NBC's TV show Meet the Press program Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu said without the current sanctions against Tehran, Iran would have billions of dollars to pump up its terror machine worldwide and, in his words, conquer the Middle East.
I prefer a diplomatic solution. You know why? Because for any military option, the country that will pay the biggest price is always Israel. So we want a diplomatic solution, but a good one, one that rolls back Iran's nuclear infrastructure and one that ties the final lifting of restrictions on Iran's nuclear program with the change of Iran's behavior.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Italian Navy and Coast Guard ships picked up about 1,500 migrants at sea in a 24-hour period. Authorities Sunday say they received distress calls from three migrant vessels in trouble in the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast. The migrants, men, women, and children, were taken to the islands of Sicily and Lampedusa. There is no word on their condition. Scientists at the European Center for Nuclear Research have restarted their Big Bang Large Hadron Collider to probe into the dark universe they believe lies beyond the visible one. The center reported Sunday that particle beams were successfully shot through the collider's 27-kilometer tunnel beneath the Swiss-French border near Geneva. The collider was instrumental in the discovery of the Higgs boson, a subatomic particle that had long been theorized but never confirmed until the year 2013. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, April 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. One of the gunmen of the Garissa University attack has been identified.
The latest is that we've been able to establish the identity of one of the Garissa terrorists. He's 24 years old, and his name is Mohammed Abdirahim Abdullahi. We know that his father was actually a chief of one of the villages there. He's called Bula Jamhuri.
Ngari Karaoke is a reporter with the Kenya Daily Nation newspaper. We'll also have a report on picking up the pieces in Garissa after the terror attack. African leaders will meet this Wednesday to strategize on finishing up Boko Haram. And President Obama calls DRC President Kabila to emphasize elections that respect the Constitution.
We as the opposition, we really appreciate what President Obama did. We think that according to what is going on elsewhere in Africa, we think that President Obama told Mr. Kabila to respect the Constitution, and we agree.
Martin Fayulu is the leader of the opposition Commitment for Citizenship and Development in the DRC. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party expelled former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, and ahead of World Health Day tomorrow, the WHO calls on governments to enact robust food safety systems. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan officials said one of the Al-Shabaab terrorists who massacred 148 people at Garissa University College was the son of a Kenyan government official. The Interior Ministry said Abdirahim Abdullahi was among four attackers killed on Thursday during the attack. The news came as Kenyans dedicated Easter Sunday services to the massacre victims, and Pope Francis prayed for those killed by Islamist gunmen who hunted down Christians while sparing Muslims. The country also began a three-day mourning period. Ngari Karaoke, a reporter with the Kenya Daily Nation newspaper, says law school classmates of Abdullahi describe him as an intelligent, well-dressed, and someone who always had a lot of money on him, which he lavishly spent.
The latest is that we've been able to establish the identity of one of the Garissa terrorists. He's 24 years old, and his name is Mohammed Abdirahim Abdullahi. We know that his father was actually a chief of one of the villages there. He's called Bula Jamhuri. We also managed to talk to some of the students who are his classmates in law school, and they actually described him as a guy who was very intelligent. He used to be very opinionated in debate. He was a sharp dresser, and one thing that stood out was his classmates would say that he used to have a lot of money or spend a lot of money, and he would look like he was well off or came from a well-to-do family. And so it was rather surprising to find that even someone who is intelligent, a law student, could be radicalized and used as one of the instruments in terror. And that has sparked a whole debate here in Kenya about now, or what is it that leads people to do such acts.
What can you tell us? There is a report that his father had reported or had told Kenyan security that his son had disappeared from home.
I'm not sure about that report, because according to some of the facts that we established and the ones we are reporting tomorrow, there is no record of the father reporting. But according from information we have from the Ministry of Interior Security, we are told that there's a sister to one of the chiefs from the same area who is missing. And so they are trying to find a connection between the two, but it is not yet linked, so we cannot really confirm whether or not there's a connection.
If all this information is true, doesn't this confirm or add to these allegations that the Kenyan government had been kind of slow to act?
Yeah, actually, there has been a lot of allegations about the slow response from the government. And as late as Sunday, the prevailing narrative has been that people commenting on security experts commenting on the slow response of the government. And yes, if the father did report that the son was missing to security agents, and I'm not sure if he reported to the extent of saying maybe he suspected he could be involved in any terrorism act, but you also know that some of these universities had received notices or warnings that there's going to be an attack, and even then there was no response by the government to either try to secure some of these institutions or act on that information. After the attack began, there was also the accusation or the response taken by the government was rather slow, because we are told that the first responders came to the school as late as 11 hours after the attack began.
So how did Kenyans celebrate Easter Sunday?
The mood was rather sad. Personally, I was at the Chiromo mortuary where families were coming to see if they can identify the bodies of their loved ones. And there was a general sense of frustration because people did not know whether the students who are missing are dead or they're in the list of the injured students or they survived but they're not reachable via the phone.
Ngari Kariuki is a reporter with the Kenya Daily Nation newspaper. You are speaking with me from Nairobi. Meanwhile, victims of the devastating terrorist attack that left 148 people dead last week in Garissa, Kenya, are trying to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. VOA's Gabe Jaslow has the story from northeastern Kenya.
The Kenyan military is keeping a tight grip on the town of Garissa after the April 2nd terror attack. Garissa County is under a nighttime curfew, along with three other counties frequently threatened by Al-Shabaab. Garissa has seen sporadic bomb and grenade attacks in recent years, blamed on the Somali militants, but nothing of this magnitude. At Garissa Hospital, student survivors recount gruesome stories of a day of horror. One student, Quentin Anyango, says she was just getting up for an early study session when the attack began.
When I moved out, I saw other three strange people with a gun. I stood for a moment, then from there I decided not to go back to the hostel, but to look for somewhere where I can hide safely.
She hid the entire day, listening to the gunshots as her classmates were executed in a nearby lecture hall. She will go back to school someday, she says, just not here.
If it is Garissa, I don't see me coming back. Kamani, if it is anywhere apart from Garissa, I will continue with my education.
Al-Shabaab said the attack was retaliation for Kenya's mistreatment of Muslims as well as its role in Somalia. But Muslim residents have been quick to condemn the terrorist group. Some local leaders have even called for Somali refugees living nearby to be sent back. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, in an address to the nation Saturday, said terrorists are plotting their attacks from within Kenya and promised a swift crackdown on those responsible.
We will not allow them to continue their lives as normal. The full force of the law will be brought to bear with even greater intensity than has been the case in previous years.
Meantime, victims of the attack are still looking for answers. At an accounting center in Garissa, workers keep track of which students out of more than 800 at Garissa University have been identified, dead or alive. David Muchiri, an instructor at a nearby college, has been poring through the lists and fielding calls from the worried parents of students still missing.
It's traumatizing, I must say it is. It is really hitting us, even us people as the neighbors of the university. We are really feeling touched because we don't know what could happen to us. Maybe we are next, we don't know.
The trauma of the attack will resonate in Garissa and towns across Kenya for some time, and any future retaliation by the government may only add to the tension. Communities here can only try their best to hold themselves together despite the forces trying to tear them apart. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Garissa, Kenya.
Western Central African leaders plan to meet this week in Equatorial Guinea's capital, Malabo, to discuss their next plan of action in the regional military offensive against Boko Haram. The meeting is being planned by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and the Economic Community of Central African States. Haruna Wakani, acting director of communication for ECOWAS, says the leaders will be mapping out a new strategy to eradicate Boko Haram once and for all.
In view of the ensuing insurgency in the northeast of Nigeria, particularly, and then its spread in some other countries of West and Central Africa, namely Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, the African leaders have decided to meet to map out new strategies of confronting this insurgency, because it is becoming a multinational menace, and so there is need for concerted effort by African leaders to tackle it.
Now, this is coming at a time that Nigeria has a new leader. So I'm assuming probably the meeting will be attended by the former president, who is still president, Goodluck Jonathan.
Yes, possibly.
What has ECOWAS done? What is the ECOWAS role here?
Well, ECOWAS has been playing a significant role in the coordination of all these efforts. It is a multinational effort, like I said. So it is not just a one-nation thing. And so most African leaders, particularly in West Africa, have shown very keen interest in tackling this insurgency because, you know, without security and safety, there will be no development. And so ECOWAS has been in the forefront in organizing these conferences to ensure that there is law and order restored in the affected countries.
You said that ECOWAS has been playing a significant role in form of what, money or military support or what?
Well, you know, as a regional organization, it is usually coordination. We may not have sufficient standing army or armaments or whatsoever, but if the member countries are properly sensitized and are coordinated to have a united front to confront insurgency or any other menace for that matter, you see, this fits into the mandate of the institution. We are a policy formulating and coordinating agency, particularly.
Haruna Wakani is the Acting Director of Communications for the Economic Community of West African States. He was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, April 6th, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16:30 past the hour. An opposition leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo is calling on President Joseph Kabila to categorically state that he will not seek a third term because the Constitution prohibits him to do so. Martin Fayulu of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party said the opposition also wants presidential elections before local government election. This comes after U.S. President Barack Obama last week telephoned President Kabila and emphasized the importance of timely, credible, and peaceful elections that respect the DRC's constitution. Mr. Kabila has not said whether or not he's going to seek a third term. Fayulu said Mr. Kabila has been laying the groundwork to run for a third term.
We as the opposition, we really appreciate what President Obama did. We think that according to what is going on elsewhere in Africa, mainly the example of Nigeria, where President Goodluck Jonathan has organized the election and the thing went smoothly, we think that with this experience, President Obama told Mr. Kabila to respect the Constitution, and we agree. Now, what we are saying, we want the calendar to be also smooth. What we want, as President Obama said, we have to discuss about the calendar to agree, all of us, how to go to the election. We want to start with the provincial. We agree. And we want the presidential and the legislative. But for the what we call the local, we have to postpone the electoral because the country is not ready to organize the local election.
You said that you want a calendar. Do you mean a timetable for the election? And you said the opposition does not want local elections?
Yes, because the timetable that was issued by the Electoral Commission is not comprehensive because it's overbooked. We have many operations, and also according to the budget is too high. $1.1 billion. What we are saying, according to the time we have now, we cannot organize in the same day the local election, the municipal election, and the urban election, plus the provincial. What we want in this year, 2015, organize the provincial election and postpone the other one after 2016. And then in 2016, we will organize the presidential and the legislative.
Back to President Obama's phone call to President Kabila. President Kabila, his team has said that he has not decided that he's going to seek re-election. So perhaps we are getting ahead of ourselves.
But this is just a tricky game. We want him to say that I will not contest. He's not saying anything, but some of his people are calling him to contest, to run. That's why President Obama is telling him that please just respect the Constitution. Even if he hasn't said nothing, but it's good to remind him that he has to respect the Constitution. That's it.
Martin Fayulu is the leader of the opposition Commitment for Citizenship and Development. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. The de facto spokesman of Zimbabwe's expelled former vice president, Joyce Mujuru, says her expulsion from last Wednesday, is a testament to her continued support from the grassroots. Mujuru was expelled for allegedly plotting to topple President Robert Mugabe. Rugare Gombo, who was also ousted from ZANU-PF earlier this year over allegations of allegiance to Mujuru, says the ZANU-PF move is a last-ditch attempt to cut Mujuru off from her massive grassroots supporters.
This is really a desperate measure to try and silence Amai Mujuru. These are desperate people who don't have people on the ground who have realized Amai Mujuru has a lot of support and that they cannot carry out their restructuring exercise with the party. So they decided to make sure that she is removed from the party so that the if there is any contestation in the future, she would not be considered. But as far as we are concerned, we continue to support her cause. We continue to work closely with her. And we think in the end, reason will prevail. The second thing I want to note is that how do you conduct a disciplinary case without the accused being there? That again shows the unprocedural and democratic way of doing things.
Rugare Gombo is an expelled member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe's service. Political commentator Nkululeko Sibanda of Huddersfield University in Britain says the ouster of Joyce Mujuru is an attempt by her opponents to make sure that she does not have any means of returning to ZANU-PF again.
I think it is an indication that those that are attempting to gain control or sustain control of the party, including the First Lady, are certainly very clear that they have to ensure that Mrs. Mujuru doesn't have any way back into ZANU-PF or any access to ZANU-PF structures using any particular excuse, such as being a member of any particular ZANU-PF structure. But also that we know that Professor Jonathan Moyo's thinking is such that when you get rid of somebody, you must ensure that they have no chance to come back, because when they come back, they hit you so hard. Just in the same way as Jonathan Moyo himself experienced, where after his own exclusion from the party, he used whatever means he still had to get back into the party and fought to completely exterminate his political opponents. And Mrs. Mujuru is an embodiment of such.
Do you see Mrs. Mujuru and other like-minded former ZANU-PF officials forming a party?
I think at the low levels of thinking about politics, it seems like a real possibility. But when you look at it deeply, it will not be advisable. I don't think that at this moment, unless something changes drastically, there is what you would call a political space for another political party in Zimbabwe. And I don't think that Ms. Mujuru has wrestled enough support from ZANU-PF to form a political party.
That was political commentator Nkululeko Sibanda speaking from London with Chris Gandhi of VOA Zimbabwe's service. In advance of World Health Day tomorrow, Tuesday, the World Health Organization is urging governments to enact robust food safety systems to protect people from contaminated foods that can kill them. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
People have to eat to live, but the World Health Organization warns that what you eat can kill you. Thanks to globalization, a vast variety of foods in and out of season now are available to people around the world. Unfortunately, the WHO says food can become contaminated with harmful bacteria, viruses, parasites, or chemicals anywhere along the complicated production and distribution food chain that has developed with globalization. The UN agency says these contaminants cause more than 200 diseases, ranging from diarrhea to cancers. For the first time, it is issuing estimates of the global burden of foodborne diseases. Department of Food Safety and Zoonosis Director Kazuaku Miyagishima tells VOA there are so many food hazards, WHO experts had to limit their research to different enteric diseases.
We picked up 22 bacteria, virus, and parasites. And according to our estimates, in 2010, the 22 different pathogens caused 582 million cases of foodborne illnesses, leading to 351,000 deaths all over the world.
Dr. Miyagishima notes the organization hopes to publish information later in the year regarding food contamination from chemicals. He says very young children globally are the major victims of unsafe food.
That was Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Egypt's El Ahly are the new Africa Women's Volleyball Club champions after beating Kenya Pipeline 24-16, 23-25, 25-20 and 28-26 in the final played in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday. Earlier on in the bronze medal playoff, Egypt's Sham edged Tunisia's Carthage 25-17, 31-29, 20-25, 17-25 and 16-14. Algeria's GS Petro is 5th, Rwanda Revenue Authority 6th, Uganda's Vision 7th, Cameroon's FAP 8th, ARSU of Seychelles 9th, and INGIS of Cameroon 10th. Kenya Commercial Bank is 11th, Botswana's Kutluano 12th, and Senegal's Soltig is 13th. Consequently, El Ahly have earned the ticket to represent Africa at the World Women's Volleyball Club Championships in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, scheduled for October. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian Girmay Birhanu clocked 2 hours 7 minutes and 26 seconds to win the Daegu Marathon in South Korea on Sunday. Kenya's Stephen Chemley and Benjamin Mutai were second and third respectively, while in the women's race, Ethiopia's Meselek Melkamu triumphed in 2 hours 27 minutes and 24 seconds. Fellow Ethiopian Dinknesh Mekesh was runner-up. In rugby, England beat South Africa 21-14 in the final at the IRB 7 series in Tokyo, Japan on Sunday. Argentina outclassed Kenya 17-12 in the Shield semi-final. At the end of the seventh leg of the nine-leg series, South Africa lead the standings with 129 points. Kenya is 13th with 33 points, while Zimbabwe is jointly 16th with 1 point. In football, hosts Seychelles face Egypt, Ivory Coast and Nigeria in Group A at the inaugural Africa Beach Football Championships. According to the draws in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday, Group B features Ghana, Madagascar, Morocco and Senegal. The six-day contest starts on the 14th of April in Victoria. The finalists qualify for the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup in Portugal in July. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The son of a Kenyan government official was one of the masked Al-Shabaab gunmen who massacred 148 people at Garissa University College. Meanwhile, Somalia's president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, says the Somali-based Al-Shabaab militant group is a regional enemy that needs to be confronted. He was speaking exclusively to VOA Somali service 3 days after Al-Shabaab gunmen stormed and massacred 148 people. That's it for this Monday, April 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark O'Woman, I'm James Butting in Washington saying have a lovely week.
Next on Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing celebrities. This light-hearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to